The Midwest radar is as clear as it has been for days out there this morning, but there are still some storms brewing. This time I'm talking about a coronavirus storm with increased confirmations and new hotspots, putting equity trade on the big-time defensive this morning. But we do have some great news to report for soybean sales.
Live from the rocky road of 2020 via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with a conversation with Dr. Alan Pratt from the National Rural Education Association, then its representative Sam Graves from Missouri, and in the final segment we've got National Corn Growers President Kevin Ross. And right after the news, Greg Henderson from Drovers. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
We need to talk to the scheduler, Davis, because I don't know if we can get that all into an hour.
I think we can do it.
You do?
Stay focused. We focus and execute. Focus and execute.
You know,
that's all we got to do.
Thursdays have just turned into a boom, 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 boom. Let's hit the issues and move on.
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
Makes a great setup for the Friday free-for-all.
Yeah, yes, it does. Yes, it does. I've got several issues that I want to talk to Congressman Graves about. A long list of items that we need to cover with Kevin Ross at the end of the show in a short period of time. And then I've been texting with and talking with some farmers about the conversation with Dr. Pratt, rural education. I've been reaching out to some farmers saying, hey, what are the big issues that you're really thinking about right now? And Davis, the amount of thought that they put into the rural education system and the thoughts that are going through their heads out there, it's going to be a fun conversation with Dr. Pratt this morning as well. I'm looking forward to that. Now, I said good news on soybeans. Export sales in the week ended June 4th, 2.2 million metric tons, a million tons of old crop beans, 1.2 million tons of new crop beans. And then on top of that, USDA this morning reported the sale of 720,000 metric tons of soybeans for delivery to China. It's one cargo of old crop beans and 657,000 metric tons of new crop beans. A big, big sale there. And the hotspots are blooming again with coronavirus. Dow was off 1,000 points, dude.
Yeah, not good.
No, and it's a lot of concern, or the concern is increasing that we are going to that we are going to see a second wave. And if we do see that second wave, some of the areas that have been reopening to business are going to have to shut down again to make sure that the hospitals aren't overwhelmed. Definitely not a conversation that we wanted to be at right now. Okay, man, what else you got in the news? Let's get going.
Well, hey, USDA's June S&D and crop production reports come out today.
Yep.
USDA will release U.S. and global balance sheets along with a new U.S. winter wheat crop projection and global production forecasts. That's at 11 a.m. Central Time today. Its old crop corn ending stocks forecast is expected to rise 52 million bushels from last month. New crop corn carryover projection is expected to rise 42 million bushels. And they only expect limited changes for soybeans or wheat ending stocks, Chip.
Yeah, and we get the winter wheat. We'll get an update to the winter wheat crop production estimate this morning as well. So we'll stay tuned for it. We're less than an hour away. No sense in speculating over it right now. Not a lot we can do about it.
Well, as you mentioned, Chip, U.S. equity futures opened the session under pressure as traders grow more concerned about a second wave of coronavirus. Yeah. Texas has reported three consecutive days of record-breaking COVID hospitalizations, and nine California counties report spikes in new infections and hospitalizations. That's according to the Associated Press. And also, Chip, international equity markets were also under pressure.
Yeah. The concern is ramping up. The next 10 days, I think, are going to tell us a lot about what to expect as far as hospitalizations go and how well they are going to be able to handle what appears to be the start of a second wave.
Yep. Tyson Foods says it is cooperating with the Justice Department amid allegations of price fixing under a leniency program that would shield the company from prosecution in exchange for assisting investigations of other poultry suppliers. In a statement to the Wall Street Journal, Tyson said, quote, Tyson took appropriate actions to address the internal issues and has been fully cooperating with the DOJ as part of its application for leniency under the DOJ's corporate leniency program. NetChip, under the leniency program, the first company to self-report its participation in a price-fixing conspiracy, can avoid criminal convictions, fines, and prison time for its cooperating employees. Interesting.
Yeah, and that as Senator Grassley is calling for the release of the investigation from Packers that was done by Packers and Stockyards into cattle price action following the fire at the Tyson plant there in Holcomb.
Well, truck drivers will no longer be able to drive unlimited hours to deliver food as regulations are peeled back from changes made in light of the coronavirus. The Federal Motor Carrier Vehicle Administration said in a statement that truck drivers delivering coronavirus testing materials, medical supplies, and livestock can continue to ignore the federal limits on how long they can drive. However, truckers delivering food will once again have to follow the rules, which some observers say indicates the department no longer sees the food supply chain as an issue.
That's positive news.
Yeah. And environmental groups, along with Democrats, are looking to reverse the recently published Navigable Waters Protection Rule, as they say it narrows the waters of the U.S. rule too much. Representative Peter DeFazio, a Democrat from Oregon who leads the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, is contesting the new rule as it leaves more than three-fourths of the streams in Oregon, California, and Arizona without any federal protection. Chip.
Yeah, we're going to be talking with Congressman Graves about that here coming up in just a little
bit.
Right. That is a crazy one. All right, let's bring in Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. How you doing, Greg?
I'm great, Chip. Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Hey, the wholesale beef prices are backing off. How are meat sales looking at the retail level?
Yeah, the 12 weeks of the pandemic ending May 24. Meat and poultry sales at retail were up $5.8 billion. That's a huge number. Pre-Memorial Day that week, they were up 20% just in sales. In volume, up about 5%. So we know that the prices have gone up dramatically at retail. One other factor to throw in here, and we all have seen the social media posts of the plant-based products still on the shelf when the meat was gone, right?
Yep.
Well, so plant-based has had a pretty good run, too. Their dollar volume is up about 70% compared to last year, and their volume is up 50%.
Wow.
Those sound like big numbers.
They are big
but
numbers.
We gotta they are for them.
Yep.
We got to remember that even with that increase, they still only get 0.66 of 1% of the share. So less than 1% of the share.
Of the consumer dollar looking for that protein.
Yes. So it looks to me what happened is we bought all the beef and pork and poultry, and then plant-based was left and said, oh, yeah, we'll take this.
Yeah, I guess if that's all that's left, that's what I'm going to have.
The good news is demand.
And I may have spent
strong.
That dollar reluctantly.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Chip.
All right. Thank you, Greg. We'll talk to you next week. That is Greg Henderson, editorial director of Drovers. Okay, we're talking rural education. Lots of issues that farmers want to talk about with Dr. Alan Pratt next. Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
If the world is your oyster, we've got pearls of wisdom on AgriTalk.
Yeah, it's a mistake coming with a song like that on a break, because it makes me just want to sit and listen for a while.
Yeah, I do too. Let's just play some records this morning. What do you say?
Yeah, all right.
We can't, right, Chip. Welcome. There's no time.
There is no time. Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip Flory. That's Davis Michelson. Davis, yes. normally by now, I would have had a belly full of walking tacos, of pulled pork sandwiches, of made rights, of all the different kinds of things that are served at the graduation receptions. But this year, as we know, it's a different story. But
I don't know Norm, but he sounds like a great cook.
But doesn't mean that those seniors aren't graduating. They are. There's lots of ceremonies and recognition going on for the seniors of the 2020 graduating class, but it's certainly not what any of them expected at the start of the school year last fall. Yeah. Let's talk about what's going on in rural education. We've got the director of the National Rural Education Association, Dr. Alan Pratt, with us right now. Dr. Pratt, welcome to AgriTalk. How are you?
Hey, doing great, and thanks for having me on to talk about rural education, rural issues. And by the way, I love the play-in song. Great choice of music, by the way.
Excellent, excellent. All right, you're my kind of guy, I can tell already. Tell us about the NREA. What is it?
So we're the oldest rural education association in America. We were founded in 1907, and we represent members in all 50 states, and we have 42 state affiliates. And our member base is from college and university researchers to teachers, principals, superintendents, and school board members. So pretty much anything that has a community touch on a rural area, the school and the community, that's going to be a part of what we're working on.
Okay. So a school stuck in rural America, what do they expect from NREA?
So we're their voice, especially in D.C., especially in during trying time during the pandemic and funding issues and equity issues. And at the forefront, you know, us being the voice of what they are needing and really relaying their message on to folks in D.C., but also at the state level through our state affiliates, relaying that message on to state government and local government as well.
Okay, so the biggest challenges that you guys face coming out of the COVID-19 shutdowns, what are they?
Well, it's, you know, not surprisingly, they're similar to beforehand in the sense of broadband connectivity and this equity of connection at home across rural remote, but also rural in general. That's probably one of the biggest ones, and that just was amplified after the pandemic and the school shutting down and going instruction online. Always looking for high-quality teachers and teacher shortages across the U.S. And then with the pandemic, we also did a lot with the USDA and our schools about feeding our students and making sure that there was a good meal and good food for our students that were at home.
Yeah, yeah, good. Let's talk about that broadband, because it seems like right now, Dr. Pratt, it's not every other day, but it's every other week at least, I get a series of emails announcing that millions of dollars have been allocated for improvement of broadband access in the state of Tennessee, in Iowa, in Georgia. The crisis, the COVID crisis, I've talked about it several times, that it's been pulling technology forward, and we're using things that we didn't really anticipate that we would be using right now, but we are using it. It's also pulling forward the need to fund those infrastructure programs out there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're looking at issues where you hear terms like homework gap and solving the homework gap crisis. You probably hear those on the news. But you also get the last mile, meaning fiber going the last mile. And a lot of times, you know, even with the money going out and millions of dollars, you still have connectivity issues. And I'm in Chattanooga today in my office, and I can drive 20 to 30 minutes and lose cell reception and have poor access to broadband and internet connectivity. So it's not rural remote, it's rural in general. So it's a pressing need and needs to be fixed immediately.
Right, right. What about funding for rural schools, Dr. Pratt? Where do we stand on that?
Well, I mean, you know, most recently we had the CARES Act that was passed by passed in D.C., and that money was allocated through Title I funding formula, and that money is being allocated to our rural districts through the state government or state education associations really now and into July. We're also obviously worried about we need another phase probably to help fund schools just because of the safety concerns and cleaning up and making sure our environments are safe when we reopen schools in August and September. So we're looking for another round of funding. The House side passed the HEROES Act. I don't think it's going to pass as it was sent over to the Senate right. side, and I don't know if we'll have anything by July or not. But those things are at the forefront of what we're watching. But we also know that anytime we're in a recession or have a recession, and especially this during this pandemic, it's year two, year three that we're worried about those sales tax numbers and anything else that's going to tag their budgets moving forward.
Yeah, those sales taxes and the loss of sales tax funding. I know that in the farm community, Dr. Pratt, there's a lot of concern or curiosity, I guess, if some of the lost sales tax money might be that some of the districts might look to make up for it with some property tax increases. Thoughts there?
Yeah, I think probably that's probably an option on the table for some. I really think that rural districts are just in a lot of times in survival mode right now, especially coming out of this and what they had to kind of rapidly react to. I don't see that being at the forefront as much as maybe looking and pushing for that more federal help and maybe some of that state help as we go into year two of this and moving forward.
And this is... This is one of those issues that I think landowners specifically are concerned is going to be brought up again 2 years from now because the schools are still going to be struggling or could still be struggling at that point. You know, I say that, but as you continue to point out, Dr. Pratt, there are the potential for some federal funding to help out these rural districts. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like going forward, but that next phase is going to be there to help out, right?
Yeah, I think the next phase, whatever it may be, is going to be a good source of income for some of our rural districts, we hope. I'll say that with crossed fingers and crossed toes. So, we hope that's the next phase.
Right. Okay. Teachers, you mentioned the teachers and always looking for quality teachers in rural, in the rural systems. You know, if we could pay them more, we could get the quality teachers, couldn't we?
Well, I mean, you know, pay is part of it. I think we need to do a better job of recruiting the students that are coming through our schools and making sure that we are, really. Basically growing your own, that grow your own model you probably heard about as well. I think those are big aspects. And I think support for teachers. And I think making them feel welcome and making them feel like a part of the community and having them a part of the community is vital for the rural schools. The other part I think a lot of people don't talk about is there's affordable housing for teachers to live in and live in communities, meaning there's not a lot of renting options a lot of times or purchasing options. So we see rural districts across the country doing some kind of subsidized housing that to attract teachers as well. I know in Colorado that's a practice, and we're starting some of that work here in Tennessee and also in Montana. So I think those things are vital. Obviously, pay is important, but it's not the only factor.
Gotcha. Okay, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, Dr. Pratt, but I had one farmer this morning ask about the curriculum. How do we better prepare farm students for the technology-heavy workplace at home? How do we better prepare a farm student to graduate from high school and have a CDL in a few months? More of the vocational training.
Yeah, it's vital. I think workforce development and workforce training and industry certifications and farm training need to be a vital part of our K-12 education. It needs to start in elementary and middle school training and raise awareness. And then also having these students in high school be able to obtain what they need actually before they graduate high school and go on to some kind of certification program or vocational trade program. So it's vital for that success. And putting, connectivity and broadband connectivity at the home, but also putting those devices and those tools in the students' hands beforehand as well.
All right, 30 seconds. I want to hear what's at the top of your wish list for rural education.
You know, the pandemic's kind of put us in the situation where equity is always been at the forefront. It's even more now. So I wish everyone would have equal access to broadband and high-speed internet that would kind of level the playing field for a lot of our students.
All right. Well, give farmers a call to action on this, Dr. Pratt. What do they need to do to help you on that?
I think reach out to your school and community locally. Reach out to our state affiliates in the state you have a state affiliate, and we'll be happy to make connections and help you out.
Dr. Pratt, let's have another conversation sometime in the future, get an update on how things are going, okay?
Sounds great. Thanks for having us on.
Excellent. That is Dr. Alan Pratt. He is the director of the National Rural Education Association. Fascinating. We're going to have more conversations with Dr. Pratt in the future. We've got Congressman Sam Graves up next on AgriTalk.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Before we get to Brian, I just want to make a note that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is off 1,060 points. We've got the NASDAQ off 235, and the S&P 500 is off about 105 points. Brian Grady, Pro Farmer Editor. Not much happening in the grain trade right now, is there?
Yeah, relatively quiet, Chip. The corn market, it's seeing gains of about a penny or two here. So some short covering ahead of USDA's reports, but the expectation is that we'll see both old crop and new crop ending stocks move up from where they were in May. So even that corrected buying interest is limited. We also are seeing a little bit of long soybean, short corn spread unwinding. So the bean market's a little bit weaker while corn is firmer this morning.
Yeah, we had some I gave the numbers on the export sales both on the weekly and on the daily this morning, Brian, but those are some of the sales that we've been looking for.
Yeah, a large part of those big totals were already in the market, and that's why we're having a muted response, I think, there. But it's impressive, both the old crop and new crop, and the daily sales as well. Very impressive.
All right, take us over to the livestock trade. What's happening?
Well, you mentioned the stock market pressure earlier, and I think that's kind of just a dampening impact on both the cattle and hog markets. We're not seeing heavy price pressure by any means, but slight to moderate pressure in live cattle, feeder cattle, and hogs right now. The exception being the nearby contracts for both live cattle and lean hogs, and they're trading just slightly to the upside. But overall, relatively quiet morning of trade in live cattle and lean hogs.
All right, we got supply and demand, winter wheat crop production coming up in a half an hour. Thanks, Brian. That is Pro Farmer Editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for. Only on MachineryPete.com.
Boy, now we've got some variety going on the bump music, don't we, Davis?
Well, environmental legislation does seem like a bit of a roll of the dice these days, doesn't it, Chip?
sometimes it does. Sometimes it does, yes. All right. Let's bring in Congressman Sam Graves, representing the 6th District of Missouri. Congressman, it's good to have you back on AgriTalk. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good, good, good. Now, I realize that this might be just a little bit difficult to talk about, but I think we need to talk about it. The flags were flown at half staff in DeKalb County, Missouri yesterday to honor Sheriff Andy Clark. Sheriff Clark was killed in a traffic accident. And with the way that things are in this country right now, Congressman, I just want to start by giving you an opportunity to honor Sheriff Clark and his family.
Well, Sheriff Clark was a friend of mine, and I tell you, he was one of the he was one of the best. And, you know, it's very tough to be law enforcement in a rural area because you have so much ground that you simply have to cover and to be able to protect all those citizens. But he did a good job. He did a great job when he came to working with the community and you know, protecting the folks in DeKalb County. And it's an absolute shame. It really is. My heart goes out to the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Before we look forward, let's look back for just a second. What's your view of the federal efforts to date to bring some relief to consumers and especially farmers out there from the economic stresses that have been caused by the COVID-19 shutdowns?
Well, it's been especially hard on livestock producers, and we're seeing money now going out the door when it comes to COVID relief, which is good. About $1.4 billion has gone out to farmers and ranchers. The vast majority of that has gone to livestock producers. So there is relief out there. You know, the unfortunate part is this is not due to anything that that you know those farmers and ranchers did in terms of bad business decisions. This is all government, you know, government response and government caused, and that's what makes it even harder. But the relief is coming.
Yeah. And there's additional relief coming at some point. I think even in the Senate, they're, you know, they're willing to say, listen, we need to pump the brakes a little bit and see how well the first phase of relief is helping to stimulate some economic activity out there. And based on that jobs report that we got on Friday, it is helping. But I think there's widespread expectations that there is another package coming. The House has already passed the HEROES Act. It's going to be narrowed in scope, but the funding for ag programs out there and ag relief, it really looks pretty good, Congressman, don't you think?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. You know, and again, a lot of those dollars have started making its way through to you know, to the producers, the individuals that need it, and we're looking at other packages. You're exactly right when you say pump the brakes. That's what the Senate is doing at the moment, to wait and see if the packages that have been passed already, if they are going to have an impact. And as you pointed out, that jobs report was something that was very, very good news in a time that, you know, in a very troubling time.
Yeah. Yeah, we needed some good news when that report came out on Friday, no doubt. Okay, the surface transportation bill. This is a big number, $494 billion. Tell us about it. What is the situation here?
It is a huge number. The frustrating part with it is, and the speaker, what's happened is the speaker's hijacked this process away from the committee, and this looks more like a Green New Deal bill than it does a transportation bill. Which we have to do. It focuses so much of the priorities, for instance, away from just core programs, things like building roads and bridges, pouring concrete, laying asphalt, and it focuses that attention. It's absolutely a seismic shift reporting, you know, and measuring greenhouse gas emissions, and puts an increased focus on bike paths and walking paths, and basically it moves a lot of dollars. This is what concerns me as much as anything. It moves a lot of dollars and focus away from rural areas into urban centers, instead of, you know, the even distribution that we've kind of seen in the past. And it's very, very troubling. But two out of every $5 in that bill is used for new greenhouse gas emission programs, and it just completely shifts it away from, you know, what we would like to see, and that's fixing roads and repairing bridges, and, you know, that laying asphalt and pouring concrete.
Yeah. You know, as soon as I said that $494 billion is a big number, I kind of caught myself, because it is a big number. It may be a justified number, but it's just how that money is being directed. It is the real issue that you have, right?
It is, let's face it, that's a 66% increase over the last highway bill. And so there's no pay-fors in that bill that was introduced, which is disturbing as well. But that means, if you just run the numbers, that means that the gas tax is going to have to double to pay out that kind of money, and the diesel tax is going to have to double. So that's got a lot of people concerned, as much as anything else, just to pay for these new, you know, greenhouse gas programs that are in the bill.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Hey, the executive order that President Donald Trump signed that permits the process for these big ticket infrastructure projects to advance more quickly. Does that have any impact on this infrastructure bill?
Well, one of the things that we were pushing on any infrastructure bill is to streamline the process. And we did that a little bit. We didn't go as far as we would like to. And that is, you know, streamline this whole process when it comes to repairing bridges or building roads, whatever the case may be. What we see is it takes so long to do the permitting and to do the studies, even to fix an existing road, to do the study on what the environmental impact is. It increases the cost exponentially. And the president has always been a very big person when it comes to getting these projects done on time and under budget, keep those costs down. And so it is going to have an impact on this, and it absolutely it goes in direct contrast to what is presented in this bill that the speaker and the progressives put out. It goes in direct contrast because this is going to increase costs in a big way when it comes to all of the mandates that are out there and removing all the flexibility that states have, but putting all those mandates out there when it comes to measuring, just measuring the greenhouse gas emissions when it comes to transportation.
Yeah. Okay. Let's switch gears to WOTUS, Congressman. It seems like we just got the new rule, and the Democrats are after it again. What's the situation?
Well, it's, you know, that was one of the best things that had happened under the administration, was removing those, I mean, just extreme, push to take away, any private property rights that we had when it came to the waters of the U.S. But
right,
they are coming after that executive order. They want to reverse it. I don't see it happening in the Senate in any way, shape, or form. I can see the House, the way the House is set up right now, or at least under House leadership right now, they might be able to get something out of the House, but I don't see it going anywhere, and I certainly don't see the president signing anything.
Okay. All right. So this is another one where there's some headline grabbing going on, you think?
It is. It's messaging. That's what it's about going into the election.
Okay. All right. Now, Congressman, here's one. You and I don't recall us disagreeing over much over the years that you've been on AgriTalk with me. But over the years, I have questioned the need for the Jones Act, okay? My thought has always been, if we need to get a ship of corn from New Orleans to Wilmington, get a ship and get it done instead of bringing it in from Brazil. But instead, the Jones Act says, no, it's got to be American-made, flagged, and manned. Is that still necessary?
Well, in some cases it is, and I do believe that it has to be a U.S. ship. It has to be a U.S. flag if you're going from one port to the next. It's this is trying to bring we want U.S. jobs, U.S. steel, and to produce these ships, and the last thing we want is a lot of. And this is where the problem comes in. When you have a lot of foreign flagships, they can operate under different rules than a U.S. flagship does. And it makes it very frustrating when it comes to those U.S. flagships that have to operate at a disadvantage, against the others. And that's the reason for the bill and the reason that we have had that for a long time, and we still have that problem. We could potentially have that problem. Okay. So I do think that – I think that the Jones Act could be tweaked in some cases when it comes to maintenance. In some cases, because that also includes, like, on the oil rigs out there, when it comes to the maintenance ships or crane ships that go out and use the very large cranes, we don't have any U.S. built. Yeah. So you do have some opportunity there, at least some latitude when it comes to maintenance. But when you're transporting goods and services from one U.S. port to another, we just want to make sure that, we don't put our shippers and our crews at a disadvantage over foreign.
Congressman Graves, I always come away feeling smarter after having a conversation with you. I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. That is Congressman Sam Graves representing the 6th District of Missouri. Okay, give us a couple of minutes, and then we're going to have Kevin Ross, president of the National Corn Growers Association. We got a lot of ground to cover with Kevin, too. That's next, Stone AgriTalk.
We don't make the news, we render it. AgriTalk.
All right, welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip Flory, got Davis Michelson with me. Man, it's been a packed show so far, and we're not going to back off right now. Kevin Ross, president of the National Corn Growers Association, is with us. Kevin, beautiful day in western Iowa, huh?
It is lovely out there today. We got a little bit of a cool down, and sun's shining again, Chip, after a little bit of rain, much-needed rain again. So we're feeling good about the way things look at the moment.
Excellent. So it's kind of an anniversary date for you, isn't it, Kevin? Remember what you were doing 1 year ago, like right now?
Yeah, I was I was a little bit nervous, I think, right now. before hopping on that stage with the president. Yeah, that was something for sure. Down there at Sire a year ago, celebrating, you know, year round E15 and having a chance to talk on those small refinery exemptions. And I said then, it was just an absolute privilege to represent the people I get to, and that was something else from an experience standpoint, that's for sure.
Yeah, I like how you say talk about the small refinery exemptions. Really, what you did was you kind of called the president out while you were standing right there in front of him and said, hey, we need to take a look at these and not do these anymore.
Yeah, it was, you're trying to find that fine art of being direct and being respectful.
Exactly.
And we're, you know, there's still a lot of that stuff that we have to do. And one, right. You know, it's one of the things I think, in my job at NCGA, having to work with, both sides of the aisle, I shouldn't say having to, getting to work with both sides
right.
of the aisle, Chip.
Right.
You got to make sure that, you can have those conversations in that respectful way get our messages across.
Yeah. Well, you obviously accomplished that because the president has been looking to you for some guidance on these issues all along, and we're still dealing with the SREs, and hopefully we can get past this and there will be none of those gap waivers issued for 2014-2015. That just can't happen.
That's exactly right. We certainly, we've been very, very vocal on this for a long time, even before that day. We just got to make sure and stay vigilant that that 10th Circuit Court ruling decision is upheld, and make sure that they go ahead and don't go down a misguided path again at EPA.
Exactly. Okay. It's a bigger bean and cotton issue, but it's an issue for corn growers as well. What's the NCGA's take on dicamba rulings?
Yeah, that's what a thing to come out in the middle of the growing season. Yeah. I mean, that's what's the most frustrating thing about it is that, you know, every farmer out there has made their planning decisions long ago in most cases, and for the majority of this crop, it's already in the ground, and you've purchased your traits on that seed, and so your decisions have been made on chemical at that same time, essentially, or pretty close to it, you know. And it's not that you don't have some options after that, but for the most part, you know, when this ruling is just handed out here last week, I had loads of calls from farmers on this thing, and as we should, you know, this is a production issue and causing major, major headaches across the U.S. because farmers don't want to do something wrong. We don't want to be, off label. You don't want to go out there and have a potential lawsuit and things like that. And so, from my perspective, even though it is, you know, a slightly bigger issue for some of our partners, we understand the precedent that this can set, from a ruling coming out that time of year. And certainly just, just that this is going to stretch beyond, the 2020 growing season. So we've got work to do in the future on this dicamba issue. And, it's right now, again, an immediate issue and immediate pain in the butt for a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
But we're working on it hard, too, with our partners out there.
Okay, very good. Talking about working within a partnership, Farm Journal is working with America's Conservation Ag Movement to help all U.S. farmers more rapidly scale to the adoption of conservation agriculture. I got to know, what is the Growing Climate Solutions Act that NCGA has endorsed?
Yeah, so this Growing Climate Solutions Act is it was introduced by Senators Braun and Senator Stabenow, and it's about it's a bipartisan effort, and it's for us talking about ag's role in voluntary practices, but ag friendly okay. things and ideas that are part of the bringing that into that climate discussion. And climate's a touchy word for people to talk about, even having that as part of the bill is something we are very, very cautious and careful of, to make sure that this is something that fits as an opportunity for corn growers, and actually is something that we're looking at to make sure is, again, is voluntary and things that implementing ideas that'll help both the environment and the farmer's bottom line. And those are big, big sure. keys that if we can get out there and make sure that this is, opportunistic for farmers, and we can stay in front of it to be in the conversation about climate change and about what should be in this bill, and what the makeup is of this thing. We've got that opportunity, and there's a lot of groups that have signed on in support of this one, and we jumped on board as well. So we think it's a good one and good opportunity for us.
Okay, just under a minute on this one here, Kevin. Boy, the study by Gary Schnitke at University of Illinois on what the COVID-19 has cost corn growers, pretty amazing.
Yeah, updated, again, $59 an acre, 19. We know that's there's more than that in certain areas, but marketed crop in an area, and $89 an acre in 2020. So we got work to do. We got a lot of crop we got to chew through, and we got to make sure farmers get the support they need.
Yeah, we certainly do. So let's hear the call to action. What do the guys need to do?
Well, right now they need to stay safe. We need to make sure that people are moving forward to get this crop in the ground and make sure it gets sprayed. Be paying attention to what comes out on all these dicamba rulings. And there's going to be some major calls to action here pretty soon, because we've got a lot of issues on the table, and we're going to need people moving.
Absolutely. Kevin, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chip.
You bet. That is Kevin Ross, president of the National Corn Growers Association. Thank you so much for listening this morning. You got to come back this afternoon. Davis and I will have the details of the crop production and supply and demand report. Jeff Wilson will come in with some perspective. And tomorrow morning, we got a free-for-all on AgriTalk.